This piece was brought to you by Underground Meats, undergroundmeats.com.
I'm Greg Blaze, host of Cutting the Curd. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hi, and welcome to A Taste of the Past. I'm your host, Linda Palaccio, on this half-hour journey through culinary history. And today, we're going to be talking about Indian food. And if I ask you what you think of when you think of Indian food, I would say most likely people would respond with, oh, curries and lots of spices. And indeed, that's something you would find. But there's so much more to the food of India. In fact, the food of India is much like the country itself, an amalgam of cultures and ethnic influences. India is one of the oldest civilizations, and it is one of the largest countries. In fact, it's the seventh largest country and the second most populated country. The diversity alone leads you to understand somewhat why there is such an amalgam of food. But you don't need to hear that from me. My guest today has just released, hot off the presses, a new book called Feasts and Fasts, A History of Food in India. And she's Colleen Taylor Sin. Colleen is an independent food historian and a writer specializing in Indian cuisine. And she's the author of several books, including Curry, A Global History, and she was on the show to talk about that with me, as well as Turmeric, which she was also on the show. She has written many other books and articles, and lately has been focusing mostly all on Indian food. Welcome, Colleen. She joins us today from Chicago. Welcome.
Hi, Linda. Thank you for having me on your show again.
The book is absolutely fantastic. It's overwhelming. And I have so many questions that I'm not sure where to start, and hopefully we'll have time. But one thing I wanted to know, because people do have an idea, they think, of what Indian food is. Is there a gastronomic culture that's common to all Indians, in your opinion?
That's a really good question, and it's so hard to answer. I mean, I tried to answer it in the book and tried to look at things that were, somebody, there was once a debate on Yelp about what is French food, and there was so much argument, and the conclusion finally was that French food is the food eaten in France. That was the definition. Well, of course, India is infinitely more diverse because apart from the fact there's dozens of languages, there's eight religions, and of course every religion has its own food ways. So if I go back in history and I look what people are now, I kind of narrowed it down to a few things, and they're really fairly small. I mean, I think the most obvious is the use of spices. That's something that really distinguishes Indian cuisine. All cultures use it, but the intensive use of spices, and this is something that goes back 2500 BC in the great Indus Valley civilization, where they found traces of turmeric and garlic and pepper, kind of a 4,000-year-old Indian curry. So that's one thing. Another thing, and this is going to sound very odd, but one vegetable that's really had been a very key role in Indian cuisine is the eggplant, or the aubergine, as they call it in England. Hmm. And I've looked at this, and all the historical research I've done, I keep coming across the eggplant. I suppose one reason is it's fairly easy to grow, and also it has the ability to absorb flavors.
Right, and certainly with the use of all those spices, I mean, it's, as you say, what a great vehicle for all those wonderful flavors. Well, you and I had discussed something earlier, and that was about why so little has been written about the history of Indian food. I mean, this is really, you could call it a seminal work that you've just done, because there really is no, maybe one other comprehensive work, not much written history on the history of food in India. Why do you think this is?
Well, that's true. I mean, the one book that really preceded me is by a professor, K.T. Achaya, A History of Indian Food, I think it's called. And it's really a good book. But it was written quite a while ago. And also, there's been a lot of archaeological discovery since then. And apart from that, there really hasn't been anything. There's several reasons for this. I think it's changing now. I think people in India are getting very interested in the history of their own cuisine. I think that there's going to be other books that are written. I know there's been a couple of somebody's doing a TV series on the history of Indian food. So I hope this changes. And one problem is that there's really been a shortage of translations from works like Sanskrit, which was the written language of India for a long time. There's a lot of works there, but some, and fortunately some were translated for my book, but others have not been. So that's kind of been a stumbling block.
Right. Well, it's interesting because you title the book Feasts and Fasts, and that takes us right into something that is a tremendous influence. We said religion plays a big role in the foods and the rituals. So feasts and fasts, all part of religion and rituals. This pretty much determines what what different sects and people are eating, correct?
Absolutely. There's a wonderful quote from Mark Twain who said, when it comes to religion, all other countries are paupers. India is the only millionaire. Because it's so true. I mean, there's eight religions. Four of the great religions of the world arose in India. Jainism, Buddhism, Hinduism, and Sikhism. And then, of course, you have Christians, you have Muslims, you have, Sikhs, and even a few Parsis. So that's really... And then even within each religion, you have different sects, you have, different regional differences. So it's really hard to generalize about what everybody eats. And even within the same religion, there are different practices.
Right. So in the early days, we're talking, 1700 BC, you had to find a jumping off point, right? And so you started the book with a chapter called The Age of Ritual. Why this period and what was going on?
Well, the jumping off point really was the Indus Valley Civilization, which was in the first chapter. I didn't call it that. But that's really, I think it's one of the most fascinating stories in the history of archaeology. And it's even now they're doing all these, it was like a million square miles. It was very sophisticated. They had trade with the Middle East. They had trade with Africa. And so even now the excavations, they found sites 60 miles from Delhi. It used to be thought it was just, in the far northwest. So that's really interesting. And they're doing analyses of residues from cooking pots, and they found or cow teeth, like what bovines. So they're finding out what people ate even then. And I'm just so excited to read about what's going on there. So that's kind of the starting point. And both for India and Pakistan, and I really have to say the title India, it's a little bit misleading, because I mean, it's only been 70 years or so that you've had these separate countries. So there really is a continuum of food. I mean, just because you cross the border into Pakistan or Bangladesh, the food doesn't change suddenly. There's great, great similarities. So in a way, I wish I could have called my book South Asia, but this is the title. So
right.
So now I've digressed. I forgot what you asked.
That's quite all right. No, it's very interesting because, indeed, when one thinks of the southern Asian cuisines and countries, all these flavors, as you say, do sort of cross the borders. And because we're all one nation
political entity, kind of. Yeah, yeah. At various times in history. I mean, if you look at maps, if you look at the greatest emperor really was the Ashokan, the Mauryan Empire. I think that was like about 300 BC. And that did cover most of the subcontinent. That's kind of the great the greatest empire, even bigger than the British Empire. So, I mean, there was a lot of going back and forth, and also there was a lot of outside influence. I mean, I mentioned the Indus Valley Civilization. India's always been a part of a global economy. I mean, even thousands of years ago, it's at the center of trade routes between Africa, between China, the Middle East. So you always had traders going by land, by sea. They were bringing things in. They were taking things out. So there's always been this wonderful interplay with the rest of the world.
Mm. And, you know, it's interesting because that also, you look at the country, you look at the area, and just as you say, things coming in from all over the world, there's also a vast variation in the climate, and that must affect the food tremendously.
Oh, absolutely. India has so many different zones. I mean, from the Himalayas and the northeast and the mountains to the coast, which is very tropical, like Kerala, where the spices originally came from, and the south, and then the desert. Oh, absolutely. Incredible. And, you know, that really determined what people ate, because until recent times, the transportation was really bad. So basically, you just ate what was grown locally. So that's another reason it's hard to, you know, define a national cuisine, because everybody kind of just ate what they could grow.
Hmm, interesting. And so you did say if any one thing tied the cuisine together, it would be the use of spices. Let's branch off into the particular religions and how those influenced the cuisines. Now, is it true that about 80% of India is Hindu?
Yes, about 80% is Hindu, and I think about, I've got a little table here. Yeah, that's the majority, and then the next largest are Muslims, and I think they're about 13%. So India really is the second largest Islamic country in the world after Indonesia. And then Christians are about 2%, and then you have small groups of other things. But even the Christians, that's 24 million people. I mean, it's
yeah,
not a 2%. Tiny amount. So all these groups have their own food ways.
Right, 2%. It's all relative of what the big number is, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. So talk to me about the Hinduism and how much, I mean, there's a lot of vegetarianism, and basically this is the cradle of vegetarianism, if you will, right?
So, it is, except that only really about 35% of Hindus are strictly vegetarian. It's really not often it's more economic vegetarianism than anything, because, you know, meat was traditionally, still is very expensive. So, and it really varies by state. Like in some states, in Western India, maybe in Gujarat, for example, 65-70% of the people will be vegetarians. If you go to Bengal, West Bengal or Kerala, it's like 2%.
Hmm.
And this reflects a lot of things, but it's hard to generalize, and who some people eat something, some people, this sounds odd, but they'll eat chicken, but they won't eat onions and garlic. So there's almost an infinite number of variations in what people eat.
Yeah, that was something that surprised me. I read that there are certain sects of Hinduism that actually forbade the use of onions and garlic.
Yeah, that's not uncommon. I mean, it started with the Jains, but even during certain fasts, for example, people usually don't eat onion and garlic during fasts. The original, there's always been a prejudice against onions and garlic, and I think they were believed to inflame the passions. I don't know if that's true or not, but to kind of excite the mind, and so they would not give, you know, they wouldn't lead to spirituality. That was kind of the belief.
Hmm. So in come all the uses of spices then, right? So, you know, we've got all the spices helping out to vary those flavors. And then a lot of lentils and beans in the diet.
Right, and I think together with lentils and together with wheat or rice, which are the two basic grains, they give you most of the amino acids you need. So, and the other thing too, it's really interesting, is very few Indians are vegans. So dairy products are always a part of people's diet, and that's very important, because if you're not eating meat, people drink milk, they have yogurt, and of course another thing I should mention as a very old and widespread ingredient is ghee, which is clarified butter, and that's always been highly valued, and it's used in Hindu cooking and in Muslim cooking. It's just considered the best, and it's considered to have all kinds of spiritual and values as well.
Mm-hmm. Now, as far as the climate and what grows well, and there is quite a use of wheat because we know they have all the different breads. Where's the – we talked about the cradle of vegetarianism. Where's the cradle of you know, the fertile cradle? Is there a particular area that grows more
like
wheat?
The, they call it the breadbasket. It's all across northern India and Pakistan. It's kind of the wheat belt, and that's very fertile. The Gangetic Plains, it's called. It was watered by the tributaries coming from the Himalayas. So that was very – and that was a great wheat-growing area. But then in Bengal and in Kerala and other parts in South India, it's a rice. Rice is the basic staple. In Western India, you had millets and sorghum, and because that was all that would grow there in the deserts of Rajasthan. It was very dry, and it's interesting because they kind of have been dying out because they were considered kind of inferior grains. Like if people could eat wheat, they much preferred it. And I'd love these breads. You can get them in Indian grocery stores. Well, what's happening now is there's a new interest in health. And so in kind of very, you know, trendy restaurants in the cities, they will be serving these ancient breads that have kind of died out of fashion because they say they're healthy and they, you know, I don't know if they are, but there's kind of this little bit of resurgence.
Not like, unlike America and other cultures where the ancient grains have taken root and are having a renaissance of their own. Right?
Yeah, I didn't think of that. That's right. Yeah
interesting. There are so many other influences that I want to touch on a couple of them, but I think it's good if we'll take a short break now, and that way we can just continue our conversation right after the break. Okay, so stay tuned.
You are listening to Mad as Dogs by The Hollows. And this is A Taste of the Past on heritageradionetwork.org.
Today's program is brought to you by Underground Meats. We're proud to count Underground Meats as a business member of Heritage Radio Network. Located in downtown Madison, Wisconsin, Underground Meats creates handcrafted salami and cured meats. They source from the nation's most quality pasture-raised heritage pigs and goats. The Underground Collective also offers a variety of classes and workshops. We encourage you to visit undergroundmeats.com to learn more. You can also get your own Underground Meats care package by becoming a VIP member of Heritage Radio Network. Visit heritageradionetwork.org/donate for more.
Okay, we are back. Got that taken care of. And I'm talking with Colleen Sen, who is a food historian and has written a marvelous book called Feasts and Fasts, A History of Food in India. So, Colleen, I wanted to talk about the many other influences that determine what Indian food is. And certainly the colonization, we can't overlook that because that was such a major part of the what happened in the culture of India. What about the influences of the Dutch, the British?
Yeah, there's no doubt. I think probably the group that had the most influence would be the Portuguese, because they were the first really to come to India, had a great empire for 100 years, which kind of collapsed. But they really brought you must have talked a lot with other guests about the Columbian Exchange. Mm-hmm. And this was this great exchange of fruits and vegetables between the Old and the New World. And, of course, they introduced things like potatoes, tomatoes, and chilies. You know, we think the chilies are ancient, but they were introduced in the 16th century. So pineapples were another thing, and all things that were really are now part of, you know, inseparable from Indian cuisine were brought by the Portuguese. And then in return, of course, India gave the rest of the world the mango and some other fruits. So that was and then in Goa, where there's still Portuguese speakers, and it became part of India, I think, only in 1948. There was there's this very wonderful Goan cuisine, which is kind of a hybrid Portuguese Indian. The most famous dish is vindaloo, which comes in the Portuguese word meaning garlic and oil. So I think they had an influence. The British had some influence, but I think in this case the influence has been stronger the other way, in as much as the colonized have really infected the colonizers in the terms of Britain, where, you know, curry is ubiquitous and is the most, you know, Indian food is the most common fast food. So I think the influence has gone that way.
Yeah, well, and actually, and that was very interesting in your book, The Global History of Curry. I was amazed to find out that you're right, and the British popularizing that Indian cuisine. Let's move on to food as medicine. Is there a lot of ritualistic and medical use, like Ayurvedic medicines and things that really look upon food as being medicine?
This was one of the things that when doing the research that I really was kind of surprised. I have to say this because there's a lot of confusion about this. And I went to the Ayurvedic texts, by Charaka and Shushruta, which were written, you know, hundreds of years ago. And what's interesting is that there's a great distinction between the food that is used to benefit yourself for spiritual benefits and those that were that were used to treat diseases. And there's a wonderful quote by one of the ancient physicians that said the purpose of medicine is not the purpose of food in medicine is not to promote virtue. What is it for then? It's to cure diseases. And so what you find is you find a lot of meat. You find even alcohol, which is usually kind of frowned upon by, you know, in traditional Indian society. You have suggestions for what kind of wine goes, what kind of alcohol goes with what food. And you have a lot of very interesting recipes that are given in these ancient books. People get this confused with, you know, the idea of the three, sattvic, tamasic, and I've forgotten the third one, the three different, rajasic, the three different kind of attributes of food. But that really comes from the spiritual tradition. It doesn't come from the medicinal tradition. And that's that really surprised me.
So talk about those spiritual attributions a little bit.
Well, there's three qualities that are both qualities of food and qualities of people. And there's rajasic, which is kind of energy. Oh, in the food, it means spicy food, food that gives you energy, and it's supposed to enhance those qualities in people. It makes you quick. Warriors are supposed to eat this food. It's supposed to give you energy and things. Then there's tamasic food, which is food that is putrid, that is old meat, alcohol, rotten food, and it's supposed to make you kind of feel sluggish and lazy, and it's not good. And then there's sattvic food, which is food that is milk, ghee, vegetables, sugar actually, and these are food that are supposed to enhance your spiritual qualities, give you enable you to meditate, give you peace, give you spiritual virtues. And actually, I think there's something to this, because when I've had a meal of, you know, steak and red wine, I really feel tamasic. I really feel sluggish and horrible. I think there's a lot to this.
Yeah, indeed. Well, the humanists had certain ideas on that, too. So it's no, you know, it's not an unusual attribute, you know, thought in philosophy and in spirituality. And it's interesting because I think that overall, the Westerners look upon the Indian culture as being a much more spiritual culture. And so the food, it's interesting to sort of hear about what religion, how the role that religion plays in what people eat. And certainly the feasts, I mean, we see the wonderful celebrations, if it's a wedding celebration or the Holi festival, or just the wonderful amounts of, you know, dancing and colors and foods that are eaten in preparation for days and days. What feasts in particular do you think have been most influential, or are the oldest ones that are continuing today? You take it.
Yeah, I don't know really. I mean, as you said, food is an important part of every festivity. There's certainly one of the things that's always associated with holidays in India are sweets. And India has an incredibly rich tradition of sweets because sugar was actually first refined in India. And India, middle-class Indians, I think their per capita sugar consumption is maybe the highest in the world. We're talking middle class. And anytime you go to visit anyone, you take sweets, you give them as gifts. And any holiday, the gods have their favorite sweets. Lord Ganesh is always shown with modaka. He loves that. So it's really, and they're usually made of milk and sugar are kind of two basic components. And obviously those are, they would give you energy. I mean, they would be, especially people who are poor, this would be a chance to really enjoy these things. So I would say that that's an important part of every festival in India.
Interesting. I know the sweets there. Michael Crandall did a lot of writing, another guest of mine, on the sweets and the sweets in India. I was amazed at just the sheer number and diversity of the different sweets and how it was big industry there.
Absolutely. My husband is from Bengal, and Bengalis are very snobbish about their sweets. And I think rightly so, because their sweets are really exquisite. I mean, there's a sweet called Shandesh that I once did a paper on Shandesh, and I ate 20 Shandeshes in one sitting. They're little fudge-like things, and I didn't feel sick. They were so good. But then we have a local sweet maker who's from Gujarat, and his family is Sukaria. They've been in the business for 130 years. The sweets are wonderful, but they're totally different. And there's seasonal sweets, there's Ayurvedic sweets, it's a whole world. I mean, someone could write this book after book on Indian sweets.
Well, it's interesting because you just even touching as lightly as we have on a lot of different areas of the food, it just seems like there's so much information that it's, and even your book was, to me, just sort of exhausting and mind-blowing because there's so many years and so much to cover. But I really enjoyed just following the timeline, if nothing else. And of course, we talked about the diaspora of Indian cuisine with the colonization, and particularly the British, and they were the best. Mm. But as far as an overview of Indian cuisine, for instance, the meals, the times of days of the meals, the types of meals. Is there a pattern that you might talk about there?
Well, usually the big meal in India is a midday meal. That's pretty universal. And it could be very late. In fact, I'm trying to think, I wrote something recently on this, a book on the meal, and I interviewed some relatives of my husband in Calcutta. Yeah, so they would eat about 1:30 or 2, and that would be the big meal. And then the dinner, and then people have another pretty universal thing is an afternoon tea. It has different names. So what happens is about, 5 o'clock, again, people would come back from work, and they would have a meal of, it would be sweets and snacks and tea or milk or coffee, depending on what they drink. And then dinner would be typically later. In Calcutta, for example, people eat dinner at 10 or even 11 o'clock. They're like the Spaniards in that sense. Mm-hmm. In Delhi, they would eat it earlier. There's a lot of regional variations.
Now, you talked about the use of ghee, and of course, anyone who has looked at an Indian recipe and knows that the clarified butter, the ghee, is important in the cuisine, as you mentioned. Is this used pretty much throughout most of the regions?
Yeah, by people who can afford it, it certainly is. I mean, I think pure ghee is a bit more expensive, but it's considered to have a lot of good attributes. And I suppose if people are calorie deprived, it is a good thing to have too.
And in cooking techniques, is there anything in particular that varies region to region?
Oh, that's a really good question. I know certain regions. I really, one thing that is not generally done in India, one technique that is missing is baking. There's very little baking. Those wonderful breads, people would take them to a communal oven. Very few people have ovens in their homes. So I think the most common ingredient really is frying, and it would be deep frying is popular, or kind of stir frying, and then of course very slow cooking. That's probably a very common thing is you saute things, you sow the spices, and then you cook add liquid and you cook over a slow fire, which in the old days would be wood or it would be cow dung, which was a popular cooking fuel, and you would just cook it very slowly. It's quite different from China, where China everything is stir-fried. It's cooked and it's served. Somebody said recently that this may be because of the, you know, you'd have a joint family, so you would have to, you couldn't kind of bring dishes out one after another. You'd have to have everything prepared and then bring it out. So that's really, I think that's the common thing. What people think of as a curry, you know, a dish with a liquid.
Mm-hmm. I saw a very thick sauce that would cover all the different vegetables or the meats. All right. Anything that you think our listeners, that you would want to tell our listeners that would sort of highlight what you feel is not a discovery necessarily, but for you, a common thread or something to, a way to approach the study of Indian cuisine?
I think one thing that's important is an Indian meal it's kind of synchronic in the sense that it's not one course necessarily after another. It can be, but not necessarily. So what you do is when the dishes are served, so you'll have your rice or your bread, you'll have some vegetables, you may have meat, you'll have maybe some yogurt like a salad, you'll have a pickle. What you do is you have to, it's kind of mix and match. And in a sense, the eater is the chef. And what I mean by that is if some people like food milder, some like it hotter. So that's the advantage of eating with your fingers, really. I think Indian food should be eaten with the fingers because you can kind of take a little bit of this and that. If you want a little bit of pickle with your meat, you can do that. You kind of mix it up and you create it as you go along. You don't eat, and like the lentils, the dal, for example. And I should have mentioned dal. That's something that's really intrinsic to almost all Indian cuisine is lentils. And so, you know, you may put some of that in your rice, you may eat that. So you kind of create the meal as you go along, and I think that's really important. And, you know, Indian restaurants have these, they've divided it up into appetizers, entrees, sides, you know, because they're trying to replicate the Western pattern, but that really isn't true. In some parts of India, you eat the sweets with the meal. In Gujarat, for example, the sweets will be served as part of the, on the thali, on the plate. So, you know, it's not one thing after another.
Interesting. Very interesting. Well, it makes me want to explore more. And I had to chuckle a little bit because you have been to India, what, over 15 times?
Yes.
Back and forth.
Yes.
Visiting family and touring. But you said most of your knowledge as far as the dishes, the modern day dishes, come from the neighborhood you live in. Correct?
Yeah. We live in a very diverse neighborhood.
And so in Little India, I suppose you would call it in
well,
Chicago.
Yeah, they don't call it that here, but that's what it is.
Yeah, but it's interesting because that if it often those the translation into another culture of the foods, it changes it a little bit, let's say like Italian American food, but do you find a lot of the Italian cuisine stays true to the roots?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you have these, like, the standard restaurant food is kind of a hybrid. But, you know, we have these, you had them in New York, too, these mm-hmm. wonderful little dhabas, these taxi cabs, and they have, like, a Hyderabadi food. Oh, I love it. There's so many of those. And it's really authentic. I mean, and it's just filled with, you know, men who don't have wives, and so the food is really good. You also have some Gujarati vegetarian places, which are very nice and serve that kind of food. So I think there's a mixture of standard restaurants and then these wonderful little, you know, hole in the wall that have really, you know, I think pretty authentic food. And these are things I bet people living in Delhi or Calcutta, I don't think they would have a chance to experience it. I think living in an American city where you have so much diversity really gives you a lot of, you know, different flavors.
Right. So they can learn about their own culture and their own regions by traveling all the way to America. That's great. Well, it's truly very interesting. There's so much more to really know about and read about, particularly in your book, and only a short time for us to talk about it. So we could only graze the top of it, and now I feel like grazing at an Indian table.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah. Well, Colleen, as always, it was a terrific pleasure. And you can read more about Colleen at her website, colleensen.com. And the book book again is Feasts and Fasts, A History of Food in India, published by the University of Chicago Press. Colleen, thank you.
Thank you.
And you've been listening to A Taste of the Past. I'm your host, Linda Palacio.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.